Father, I thank you for this teaching today, and I pray that only your words will come forth and flourish and bloom like Aaron's rod, and that anything that I say that is of myself, that will fall to the ground and die, and no one will remember. And Father, I just thank you for this Shabbat, and I pray that you'll be with us in our Midrash as well after the teaching is over. In Yeshua's name, amen. Okay, so the thing about this Torah portion is that it's one of the two that people remember the most, one of the two rebellious times that people remember the most. The first one is the, of course, the 10 spies. But then Korah gets in here, and he now is going to try to take these people back to Egypt. And so people remember Korah. This episode is a very famous episode in the Torah portion, or in the Torah. And this portion has significant prophetic value. But what I'm going to do to show you where Korah, where this episode fits into the prophecy, instead of going through, you know, all of the things and, you know, talking about how, what egos and hubris these people had, and how much they hated Yahweh, and they hated Moses, and they hated Aaron. Instead of going all through that, I'm just going to show you where Korah, where this episode fits into the prophecy of the end times ingathering. I'm going to take you to Revelation 22, verse 11. Where it says, you know, 22 is the last chapter and of Revelation, of course, and so everything is pretty much over at that point. But there's an interesting verse in there, which is verse 11, and it says, "He who acts unjustly, let him act unjustly still. He who is filthy, let him be filthy still. He who is righteous, let him do righteousness still. He who is pure, let him be pure still." And that comes from the Accurate New Testament, the ANT version. The word, therefore, unjust is G91. That is adikeo. That comes from G94. And G94 is adikos. They both mean to be unjust and by extension to be wicked and treacherous. So that unjust isn't, that really is not a strong enough word for what should be there. Korah was being treacherous. And one of the English words for adikeo or adikos is treachery. Any time that somebody comes forward to try to dethrone a king's administration or the king himself, that's called treachery. There are other ways that we also do treachery, but in this instance, Korah is trying to steal the priesthood. Well, in the end of days, we're going to see similar things. We're going to see some continuing in rebellion and some continuing in righteousness, just as is now happening in this Torah portion in the wilderness after the first generation. And of course, this is going to happen even after Yahweh, Yeshua, has made his decisions and his judgments about who gets in the kingdom and who doesn't, just as that happened already in the first generation's wilderness experience. Korah's rebellion is now coming after Yahweh's final test, the 10th test. And of course, this is in the wilderness, where Yahweh judged that his newly founded congregation was unfit to enter the promised land. But Korah, from the tribe of Levi, is leading the way in this rebellion. Now, there's 250 princes with him. You know, they're from all the tribes are involved in this. But Korah is the one who has stepped up to the people's request to return to Egypt in Numbers 14:4. And this is why Korah is trying to remove Moses and Aaron. He first has to lead the people back to Egypt, but he needs to prove to the people that Moses and Aaron were not chosen by God to lead Israel if he's going to actually get them to follow him. Because, you know, Moses has done the greater thing. He has brought them all out of Egypt. And he has led them through the wilderness. And even though they don't really care for Moses and Aaron's policies very much, because, you know, those are Yahweh's policies and these people don't really like those policies, nonetheless, Moses has proven himself to be a leader. Korah now has to prove himself. So now he has to try to, take away, usurp, or do a coup of the new government to put himself in leadership so that he can take all these people back to Egypt. Now, last week, Joshua and Caleb had told the congregation to not rebel against Yahweh after the spies brought the evil report of the land. Numbers 14, verse 6. Joshua, the son of Nun, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, were of those who spied out the land, and they tore their clothes. They spoke to all the congregation of the children of Israel, saying, "The land which we passed through to spy it out is an exceeding good land. If Yahweh delights in us, then he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey." And by the way, the accusation of Dathan and Abiram is that they lived already in a land flowing with milk and honey, Egypt, you see. And so they are disingenuous in their memory. They apparently didn't remember that they were under heavy burden under the Egyptians. Now it's Egypt that flows with milk and honey, and you, Moses, haven't managed to get us to a land of milk and honey. So putting this all on Moses and not themselves, this is what people do, you know, as we go through life, they want to blame everybody else for their problems and their misfortunes. Dathan and Abiram are of that ilk. Blame Moses, because Moses' job was to do that, and the children of Israel didn't have anything that they needed to do, like, keep the Torah, for instance. Verse 9, "Only don't rebel against Yahweh, neither fear the people of the land, for they are bread for us. Their defense is removed from over them, and Yahweh is with us. Don't fear them." So the entire congregation except Joshua and Caleb were judged in that situation as unfit to enter the land. Now here is a rebel, Korah, and his company of 200 princes, continuing to rebel. This, after the judgment rebellion, will be repeated in the end of days. The hard heart that rebels will remain hard, as it says in Revelation 22:11, and it will not turn back to Yahweh after Yahweh has judged or put the person under the rod. That is the meaning of Revelation 22:11. So how a person is at the time when they are judged is how they will remain. At the point of judgment, that means there's no more chance for turning, no more chance for repentance. The word rebel is morad, H4775 in Hebrew, and it is this word that is related to the Greek word adikeo, G91, which also means treachery, and it means to act wrongly as well. And adikos, as I said before, means wicked and treacherous. So that is how Revelation 22:11 ties into this account and gives us a description of what it will mean for us in the desert wilderness after Yahweh separates the rebels from the righteous, which we read about in Ezekiel 20, verse 35. Korah, continuing in his wickedness and treachery and in that kind of behavior, and the behavior of those who are with them, now sets up a prophecy having to do with the end times generation that we read about in Revelation 22:11, and later on I will point out in Daniel chapter 12. And this perspective fulfills what Yahweh told Isaiah. And Isaiah 46:10, he says, I declare the end from the beginning, and from ancient times, things that are not yet done. I say, my counsel will stand, and I will do all that I please. And Isaiah 48:16, come near to me and hear this. From the beginning, I have not spoken in secret. From the time that it happened, I was there. Now Yahweh has sent me with his spirit. And so what Isaiah is saying here is that if we want to understand in the end of days what is going to happen, we need to go to the beginning. And Korah is an explanation of what's going to happen in the end of days after the rebels are purged from the congregation in the wilderness of the people. So we have to remember that interpreting the prophecies, we have to always look back for previous patterns. Once we know the patterns, we know what to look for. And one of the end times patterns that will show up will be the 10 tests. We'll have those in the wilderness of the people. And then we're going to have the same thing that will come after Yahweh puts everyone under the rod. In this week's Torah portion, the people have now been tested, and they've been judged unfit for Yahweh's kingdom. That ended in last week's Torah portion. So in this week, we have a new scenario. But what Paul tells us about these tests is that they are there for us to learn from. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 1 says, now I would not have you to be ignorant, brothers, that our fathers were all under the cloud, and all passed through the sea, and all were baptized to Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and all ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of a spiritual rock that followed them, and the rock was Messiah. However, with most of them, God was not well pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. See, these this is a good hint here that there's going to be a remnant. God was not well pleased with most of those people, but there was a remnant that was left. Verse 6, now these things were our examples, to the intent that we should not lust after evil things, as they also lusted. Don't be idolaters as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. That's again a reference to the golden calf. Let's not commit fornication as some of them committed. And in one day, 23,000 fell. Let's not test Messiah as some of them tested and perished by the serpents. And that Torah portion with the serpents is coming up. Don't grumble, as some of them also grumbled and perished by the destroyer. Now, all these things happened to them by way of example, and they were written for our admonition, on whom the end of the ages have come. So these are for us to learn by. So what we need to do is learn not to do those 10 things that they did in the first generation to begin with. And then we need to understand what's going to happen after Yahweh has put the people under the rod. And now, then we start to have the Korah episodes and so forth. Yahweh said that he gave the people adverse conditions to test them. Exodus 20:20, and Moses said to the people, "Do not fear, for God has come to test you, and that his fear may be before you, so that you may not sin." Deuteronomy 8:2 says, "You shall remember all the ways which Yahweh your God has led you these 40 years in the wilderness, that he might humble you." What does that mean? It means to bring you into obedience of the Torah, to be humble. That's what that original meaning is you're obedient. Moses was called the most humble man on earth because he was obedient to the Torah. And then it's to prove you, to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. See, this, what's happening today in this Torah portion with Korah, his 250 princes, and Dathan and Abiram, these are all matters of the heart. Now, don't think that Yahweh does not know what is in your heart. He already knows, but he needs us to know, and he wants us to know for a couple of different reasons. You know, he does nothing in secret, so it won't be a secret why so-and-so did not make it. Yahweh wants all the secrets of our hearts to be exposed, because he doesn't want anyone wondering later on why so-and-so didn't make it. Yahweh's testing in the wilderness of the people will show us who does not belong in the kingdom and why. You know, in Deuteronomy later on, it says that the secret things will all be exposed. So that's reason number one why he wants us to know what is in our and other people's hearts. Reason number two is because us knowing, each one of us individually knowing, is also part of our test. Our test is whether or not we will accept his judgment and accept that not everyone we love will make it into the kingdom. We all will have loved ones who turned out to be Korahs, or princes with Korah, or people who were neighbors and in agreement with Dathan and Abiram, or, you know, part of the whining and complaining congregation. So it isn't that Yahweh does not know what is in your heart. He does know. He tests us so that we personally, each and every one of us, and everyone else, will know what is in our heart, for the way he has judged us, whether he's judged us to be righteous to enter the kingdom or unrighteous to not enter. And once the judgment is made and there is found those who are wicked among us, he tells us to stand back from those whose hearts have been shown to be marad, rebellious, and adikeo, wicked, like Korah, Abiram, Dathan, and the 250 princes from all the tribes who were with Korah. Now, you know, Korah's heart was just like Pharaoh's. His heart was so hardened that he became unredeemable. And that is not Yahweh's fault. It is Korah's fault. If somebody's heart gets that hardened, it is not Yahweh's fault. It is their fault. And the reason is this for Korah. In Numbers 16:8, Moses said to Korah, "Hear now, you sons of Levi, is it a small thing to you that the God of Israel has separated you from the congregation of Israel to bring you near to himself, to do the service of Yahweh's tabernacle and to stand before the congregation to minister to them, and that he has brought you near and all your brothers, the sons of Levi, with you? Do you also seek the priesthood?" Well, the thing that hardened Korah's heart was ambition. We need to let go of our ambitions. Fleshly desire for status in society, that is ambition. There are things that we should desire in Yahweh's kingdom. Those are things that, like to be able to serve the king. That's a different story, though. I'm talking here about fleshly ambition. Pharaoh would not give up his status as God of Egypt. You know, the ancient pharaohs, they were the God of Egypt, and they represented all of the lesser gods. The pharaoh was the supreme God, and all the other gods were lesser gods. Well, he was not going to give up his status as the supreme God of Egypt. And Korah's own heart was the same as Pharaoh's. So because this happened before in the first generation, Yahweh will test us in the end of days in the wilderness of the people as found in Ezekiel 20, just as he tested the first generation to expose what is in their hearts. Ezekiel 20, verse 33, "As I live, says Adonai Yahweh, surely, with a mighty hand, with an outstretched arm, and with wrath poured out, I will be king over you." Now, I want to stop here and just explain. You know, often people read this and they say, oh, he's going to bring us into the ingathering and into the wilderness of the people, and there's going to be wrath when he brings us. He's going to pour out his wrath on the world. No. He's pouring out his wrath on his own people. With wrath poured out, he will be king over his people. "And I will bring you out from the peoples and will gather you out of the countries in which you are scattered with a mighty hand, with an outstretched arm, and with wrath poured out. I will bring you into the wilderness of the peoples," and as I've explained before, that is in the areas of Moab and Edom, and specifically, probably there in Kadesh Barnea, which is a section carved out of both of those wildernesses of Zin and Paran. "And there I will enter into judgment with you face to face, just as I entered into judgment with your fathers in the wilderness of the land of Egypt. So I will enter into judgment with you, says Adonai Yahweh. I will cause you to pass under the rod." Passing under the rod is going to be judgment. I'm going to go into that a little bit more here in a minute. And he says, "And I will bring you into the bond of the covenant." Bringing us into the bond of the covenant means to bring us into his sheepfold, his kingdom. But first, we have to be judged. We have to pass under his rod. So we're going to take a look at the shepherd's rod. The rod was the shepherd's way of simultaneously counting and examining his flock. Each sheep was not only counted, it was examined in case something had happened to it during the day or the night, or perhaps it had gotten wounded or was sick for some reason. Shepherds counted their sheep in the morning, in the beginning of the day, and again in the evening at the end of the day. So they counted their sheep twice a day. The morning counting was done to make sure he did not have less sheep than he should have from last night's count. If he had less sheep, that meant there was either a hole in the pen or someone had come and stolen a sheep. Then, in the evening, when he brought them back from the pasture, he also made sure that he did not have less sheep than he was supposed to have, because missing sheep meant that the shepherd now has to go out and find the lost sheep. That's what Yeshua said that he was doing. Some of the sheep had gone lost, and he had come to find his lost sheep. In the evening, though, he may also have more sheep than he was supposed to. This could mean trouble if another shepherd came looking for his lost sheep. Of course, the shepherds knew each other, but what if they were on the outs and the shepherd said, "You stole my sheep"? You know, there could be a problem. But even if there was no trouble from another shepherd, an honest shepherd wanted only his own sheep. So in the event of an overage at the evening, now I'm going to lay this out as Yahweh's morning being Genesis 1, you know, at the foundation when the earth was created, and the evening being at the end of the 6,000 years, so that you have kind of an understanding of why I'm saying morning and evening. At the end of the evening, he might discover that he had an overage of sheep. How could he tell which sheep belonged to him? Well, his sheep know his voice. All sheep know their shepherd's voice. So he could call the sheep. He could remove himself from the sheep, and he could call for his sheep. And those who do not come when called, they're not obedient. They are not his sheep. That's the test. The test is in the calling, who obeys and who rebels. So in Yahweh's morning at the foundation of the earth, he predestined Israel, Romans 8, 29 and 30, and Ephesians 1, verses 3 through 5. And at that time, he took account of the sheep that belonged to him. In John 10, 27, it says, "My sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me." So that's the test. Who will follow the shepherd's voice? Korah was not one of Yahweh's sheep. The 250 princes, Dathan and Abiram, they were not Yahweh's sheep. And by the way, most of the congregation were also not Yahweh's sheep. There were people, however, in the congregation that were Yahweh's sheep, and we know at least some of them by name, Moses, Aaron, and at least some of his sons. We're going to learn about one of those sons in a later Torah portion who it said had zeal for Yahweh. Of course, there's Miriam and Joshua, Caleb, Moses' wife, probably, along with some other unnamed individuals. Those are Yahweh's sheep. But let's get back to the sheep in the wilderness at the end of the day, as it were, when Yahweh will put his flock under the rod and he will count his flock again. As I've said before, this will happen in the wilderness of the people, according to Ezekiel, and Yahweh will find that there are some who are not part of his flock. He will find that there's an overage. And so he's going to use the rod for judgment. Are you mine or are you not mine? And people are going to give different responses. There's another use of the rod besides judging. The rod is also used for chastisement. In Psalms 89:30, it says, if his children break my law and don't walk in my ordinances, if they break my statutes and don't keep my commandments, then I will punish their sin with the rod and their iniquity with stripes. Now, you probably know by now that the rod is also a metaphor, an idiomatic term for the Torah. And so if we put that together, and he chastises us or he judges us, he is doing so according to his Torah. Well, here is a quote from Gill's exposition of the entire Bible. He puts it this way. It says, and I will cause you to pass under the rod. That is, such whom God will not take vengeance on and shall not die in the wilderness of the people, but whom he will have mercy on and show favor to and bring at length into their own land, which is Israel. These he indeed will bring under the rod of correction and chastisement, which is part of the reason for us being in the wilderness of the people for 1260 days, is for those who need to learn more about the Torah, which is probably all of us. Me too. I don't claim to know everything there is to know about it. It's just for going to be for our correction. By which they shall be brought to a sense of sin, to confession of it, and humiliation for it, and to seek their Messiah for salvation from it. But here's an interesting part of this Gill's exposition. It says he will strike and mark them. So strike is the chastisement, and marking them with his rod. Leviticus 27:32 talks about that. And thus, as the Lord has in election distinguished his sheep from others, taken an exact count of them, and set his seal or mark of foreknowledge on them, so in effectual calling, he separates them from others. So in the desert, in the wilderness of the people, when he calls his sheep, that's how he's going to separate them from those who are not his sheep. He will take special knowledge of them and set his mark of sanctification on them. So Yahweh will put his people under his rod to make sure who are his, so he can rightly put his mark on them. That will be the ultimate purpose. So let us be counted worthy to be tested and not try to avoid being tested. Let us welcome the testing. But unlike Korah, let us allow the testing to make our hearts soft and our souls willing to comply completely with Yahweh, with his Messiah, and with his Torah. A third use for the rod has to do with being obedient. For those who walk in Yahweh's Torah, his rod is a comfort. We read about that in Psalms 23, and I'm going to quote a little bit more from that later on. And fourth, there's another attribute of rods that we need to understand. Rods bloom. And their blooming in this Torah portion was a testimony to all Israelites that it was Aaron and his line that's the authority in the tabernacle and the temple. This also has a consequence, though, for Aaron and his line. He and his line will now bear any and all iniquity that happens there. You know, Aaron perhaps maybe needed to be a little more you know, paying more attention, a little more aware of what was going on in the congregation than he was. He maybe, yeah, you know, we can say that perhaps Aaron needed to know that his own brethren from the line of Levi were getting ready to try this coup to overthrow the government, which, by the way, wasn't the first time this had happened. It happened with Nadab and Abihu. He was supposed to be more aware. So this blooming of the rod is a sign for the people of Israel, but it's also showing him that he bears all the iniquity of what happens there. And this is a huge responsibility, which is why the rest of us don't need to be usurping that authority, lest we be called by Yahweh to bear the same iniquity. You know, I'm talking about things like setting calendars, for instance. And I know I harp on that, but it is no small thing to have authority over Yahweh's creation. That's really what it means. They have authority over setting the timing of the feasts, and that has to do with recognizing Yahweh's creation. You know, and today, many of our Israelites have no qualms about setting other calendars. It amazes me. People should be shaking in their boots, but they are not. And this is not a small issue about the calendar. After Aaron's rod bloomed in Numbers 17:12, the children of Israel spoke to Moses and said, "Behold, we perish. We are undone. We are all undone." Well, you know, finally, they now understand that Yahweh is not one of their manipulatable Egyptian gods. Numbers 17:13 says, "Everyone who keeps approaching Yahweh's tabernacle dies. Will we all perish? If you keep approaching Yahweh's tabernacle with bad intentions, yes, you're going to die. You're going to perish." So they also now finally understand that they're not going into the promised land because they have failed their tests and they've rebelled against Yahweh one too many times. That final time had to do, of course, with their agreement with the 10 spies that the land was not worth going to, and they wanted to return to Egypt. So, the rebels will not stop rebelling. We're going to hear more in the future Torah portions about the continued rebellion of that first generation. You know, they're not going to stop rebellion after Yahweh puts them under the rod. The rebels will be purged. They will be removed from us because he's not going to let them continue to entice others to rebel. So those who are wicked and in rebellion must die in the wilderness of the people, as Korah and his cohorts and all the people who Yahweh will kill by various means must die. The various means being plagues, getting swallowed up by the earth, being consumed by Yahweh's fire, being bitten by stinging insects, being killed by Amalekites at the outskirts of the camp. These are all different ways that are listed in the Torah. Part of Yahweh putting us under the rod and counting us at the end of the day has to do with who gets to enter into his sheepfold in the wilderness where they will be protected. Micah 2:12, "I will surely assemble you, O Jacob. I will gather the remnant of Israel. I will set them together like sheep in a fold, like a flock in its pasture, a noisy multitude of men. He who opens the breach goes up before them. They break through and pass the gate, going out by it. Their king passes on before them, the Lord at their head. Now let's take a look at the sheepfold as it will be for those who are obedient after the rod judgment and after the rebels, the marad, have been purged from our midst. Psalm 23. Verse 1, Yahweh is my shepherd. I shall lack nothing. We will not lack anything. We will be nurtured and cared for. Our bread and water will be sure. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. So why will Yahweh provide green pastures and still waters? Isaiah 33, 15 and 16. He who walks righteously and speaks blamelessly, he who despises the gain of oppressions, who gestures with his hands, refusing to take a bribe, you know, somebody gives you a bribe, you wave it off, who stops his ears from hearing of blood and shuts his eyes from looking at evil, he will dwell on high. His place of defense will be the fortress of rocks. And here's this part about nurturing. His bread will be supplied. His water will be sure. Psalm 23:3. He restores my soul. He guides me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. So he will teach us his ways during this time and renew the covenant with us. Ezekiel 20 verse 37 says, I will cause you to pass under the rod and I will bring you into the bond of the covenant. Why must he renew it? He has to renew it with us just as he renewed it with the second chosen generation. And we, spiritually speaking, are the second generation. The first generation was the one from Mount Sinai to the cross. You see the bigger pattern now. The second generation, though, is us from the cross to the kingdom. So just as he always does, he will renew the covenant with us. He will bring us back into the bond of the covenant. He did that at the end of the book of Exodus for that first generation. And last week in the Torah portion, he renewed the covenant again after the 10 spies. Remember? Psalm 23:4. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. Now, a lot has been written about this valley of the shadow of death. I'm going to speak about it just in the context of the wilderness of the people to tell you to understand that during that time, we will be under constant threat and we will get to see our Savior's mighty outstretched arm and his miracles which preserve us. But why do I say we will be under constant threat? Because the first generation was under constant threat from Edom, from Esau. And now we have that nation called Iran, which has a mixture of the Amalekites in it. And so they're not going to stop after they get Jordan and Israel and so forth after the attack of the king of the north against the king of the south. And they're going to think that, you know, what a convenient thing it is that they've got all of Yahweh's Jacobite people. My goodness, Esau wants to get rid of the Jacobites. You know, oh, they're so smart. Look, they've all gathered out here in this wilderness and they're all holed up in this sheep pen. My goodness. Well, we'll take care of them later. Let's go ahead and finish off going around the world and converting everyone to Islam, and then we'll come back and take care of them, you see. So that's going to be the thought of them. But Isaiah 54:17 says, No weapon that is formed against you will prevail, and you will condemn every tongue that rises against you in judgment. That is the heritage of Yahweh's servants, and their righteousness is of me, says Yahweh. Psalms 23:5. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup runs over. Again, our bread and water will be sure. But not only will it be sure, but he will let his enemies know that we have bread and water and that he's taking care of us and we're well fed and our cups are running over. Psalm 23:6. Surely, goodness and loving kindness will follow me all the days of my life. And I'm going to add a word here. And then I will dwell in Yahweh's house forever. Now, why did I put it that way? Well, his goodness and mercy will follow us for all of that time in the wilderness to the resurrection. So we have already looked at Revelation 22:11. From where did John understand this concept of let the unjust, the wicked be wicked, and let the filthy be filthy, let the righteous be righteous, and let the pure be pure? Where did he get that? From Daniel. But, you know, John got an expanded understanding about that. He expanded it. And here's what Daniel had to say. In Daniel 12:9, the angel told Daniel, go your way, Daniel, for the words are shut up and sealed until the time of the end. By the way, the words of Revelation are not sealed. Verse 10, many will purify themselves and make themselves white and be tried, or tzaraf, that's Strong 68:84, to be tried with fire, like metal is refined. And that fire is going to play a part in the red heifer sacrifice or slaughtering, actually, which is coming up in the Torah portions. But the wicked will do wickedly, says Daniel, and none of the wicked will understand. That's a part that John did not put in his expanded understanding. But it says here that those who are wise will understand. Both Daniel and John understood something about the people at the end of days, which is that he who acts unjustly or wickedly will continue to act unjustly or wickedly, and that he who is filthy and refuses to get cleaned up by repenting and agreeing to live Yahweh's way according to the Torah, he will be filthy still, and he will be cut off. And this is how the rebels will continue after they have gone under Yeshua's rod. Inexplicably, those people will act as if their judgment never happened, or maybe even as if Yeshua is either powerless, you know, they'll be mocking him or something, or perhaps that he is nothing and that he even never existed. We've heard all of these things from former believers before. After a period, and I think it's going to be a short period of time, Yahweh will kill them. However, they will totally disregard him to their peril, and they will perish. But it also says he who is righteous will be righteous still, and he who is pure will be pure still. Those in the wilderness will come and remain there because they are faithful to Yahweh's covenant with Israel at Mount Sinai, which is the Torah. They will not be rebellious. That's why they can qualify to be in the wilderness of the people. They will be people who have been Torah obedient. They have the testimony of Yeshua, and they keep his commandments. And then the righteous and the pure will dwell in Yahweh's house forever. Amen.